Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse. This is the time of the week where we discuss the latest DevOps news, AWS announcements, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SweetOps community. Plus, there's a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We are a DevOps accelerator for AWS that helps teams get to production faster. And we do this by leveraging our proven reference architecture. So if you're curious to learn more, just go to cloudposse.com. Now, how can you maximize today's session? Well, first off, our format is very informal. You can engage as much as you'd like. And if you're curious about any of our open source tools like Atmos, this is a great place to ask. So for those on the recording, we host these calls live. Join us by going to cloudposse.com/office hours. Again, cloudposse.com/office hours. I do have one ask. If you find any portion of this session valuable, share it with your team. That includes you, Jonathan. No, I'm joking. And we will be posting a recording of this session to our YouTube channel in about an hour or two. So with that said, let's see what crossed my desk this week. All right. Bypassing GitHub action policies. So this was something I just caught my attention during my lunch break. I think it was posted on Hacker News right now. And I feel like there's some FUD around this article, but it's also an interesting article because for other reasons. So I think it's first, A, important to understand how GitHub actions work. B, understand that you could do this. And C, that this is identical to like any GitHub action that downloads any binary. The fact that a GitHub action can do what it's doing here, what I'm about to show you, isn't any different from that. So this article is showing something two good things about GitHub Enterprise, especially. I think you can do some of these controls in regular GitHub as well. You can restrict where GitHub actions can run. So GitHub actions are like orbs. If you come from the CircleCI world, they are reusable jobs kind of or workflows that you can call from the AWS marketplace or from your own GitHub repository. Essentially, any GitHub repository can be a GitHub action if it's designed the right way. You can restrict in your organization who can run those GitHub actions. You can say, hey, we only allow GitHub actions that we've written. So you could maybe fork an action into your org if you wanted to use it, or just write your own. Or you can say any GitHub action from some specific organization can be used, or only this GitHub action from a specific organization can be used. I don't know if you can restrict it to a specific commit SHA, off the top of my head, but if somebody does know, speak up. So there's another really cool thing about GitHub actions. And that is that you can use GitHub action. There's different types of GitHub actions, first of all. You have containerized actions, which are really efficient because they are just based on an OCI image. And for example, if you have some TypeScript action that can be fully bundled in a GitHub action that's a container image and run it that way. Okay, one way. The other way is you have something called a composite action, and a composite action allows you to take a series of steps like this and stick it into an action. So a composite action can, it can't have jobs, but it can have any number of steps in there that run. So it's a way for you to dry up long workflows where you have maybe reusable parts of a workflow into an action. And the other way you can invoke an action is just locally, referentially, self-referentially, like in a as a step in your workflow here. So what this quote unquote attack vector is doing is it's cloning another GitHub action, and then it's using that GitHub action in the next step. And the author asserts that this is bypassing the policy controls that GitHub has on what GitHub actions you can call an organization. And yeah, I get the point. And in a perfect world, this should also be captured. But there's a million ways you could get around this kind of thing. And it's really not much different than 99% of the other GitHub actions, which download a binary and run something. So in this case, we are running a workflow or a set of steps like this. And in the other one, we're running a binary, and both of them have a significant attack surface. So if you don't have other defenses in place, you I see Matt twinging here, but
Yeah, because I think the reason I'm looking kind of dubiously is I believe I tried to do this before for something that we were trying to work on, and it wouldn't allow you to do it unless that like
You
that
can't do for
existed.
shared workflows, and that's the kicker. So we were hoping to do this where this step here created a shared workflow, and then this step here called that shared workflow, and that is not valid. But you can run it on a GitHub action. You cannot run it on a shared workflow, and I'm absolutely certain by that one.
Yeah, okay. Which is strange because it's the same syntax.
It's very similar syntax, but it is different.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, interesting. Interesting that they allow one and not the other. So, in the other case, just to finish the thought off, it wouldn't allow us to do it unless that action was in place in that directory, like prior to our commit. Like happening it, so they were preventing this from th this scenario from occurring, basically.
So I guess maybe I didn't read the full article, and maybe what he's asserting is that this should work the same way that shared workflows work in terms of protecting it, that it must exist when it begins. But honestly, I think it's kind of nice, and we have used this pattern before. For example, to clone, it used to be at least that you could not call GitHub Actions. If you're using GitHub Teams, you could not have private GitHub Actions, and this was the workaround to that. I don't know if that's still true, but this was the workaround we used for that. What we were trying to do then was really cool, I thought. Non sequitur, but we were trying to generate a static GitHub matrix that we would then call in the next step. Well, not a matrix, a static GitHub action workflow, similar to what a matrix can do, but one where we could guarantee the order of the steps. And that was impossible because you cannot generate a shared workflow and call it in the same execution. So moving on. So then he goes on that there is no fix for this, and GitHub says they're not going to fix it. And I can see both people's points, but to me, as long as you can download something and execute it, whether it's a workflow or a binary, it's the same sort of attack vector or the same implications.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that this is a that this is an action is somewhat, inconsequential because in your GitHub workflow itself, you can curl anything you want and execute it like out there, right? So as long as you have access to it somewhere, you could curl a malicious binary, you can, chmod it to executable and then actually run it, like no problem. Or you can copy and code from wherever you want and then run it. Or you can have an action script where you can run arbitrary JavaScript to do whatever you want it to do as a step. So, I mean, I think like this part probably isn't that, isn't that dangerous given everything else you can do in jobs and workflow steps, so.
So the issue is, if you let something reach main or production that is using this kind of pattern, that is your problem. It isn't the problem that GitHub Actions could do, because for all the reasons Matt said, there's other ways the same thing could be circumvented. All right. Any questions on this before we move on? All right, next one is something that obviously I don't know how well it works, but I wish we had this a couple months ago when we were going through the exercise of figuring out what was costing a lot of money. And we did what most people do. You go to the Cost Explorer and filter out what's there by tags and so forth and accounts. Here's now an MCP that gives you that same kind of capability. So you can just have a conversation with AWS cost control, presumably, and get the same kind of information instead of pinging your engineer, like, hey, why are we spending so much right now on in such and such account? All right. This is not an official AWS project, but AWS has a lot of their own MCPs now too. This was probably the most exciting announcement for the week. In an up, I don't know if this is supported on the current version of Mac OS, but in the next, what is it, Mac OS 26, it's going to support native OCI containers, Linux containers, using lightweight virtual machines. Using the native virtualization that Mac OS has. So, obviously, containers have become a cornerstone of modern development. And, I guess also used obviously in server applications on Mac OS, I'm guessing as well. So, having first-class support for this is nice. Also, there's been a lot of uncertainty, after Docker, started charging for Docker and it being such a kind of it's a utility almost today of engineering that making it commercial is unfortunate but understandable. So Matt, were you okay? So with this, hopefully, what we'll also see is a lot more performant containers and a lot more secure containers for Mac OS. It also will support the same syntax of the Docker CLI we know and love, and that works with all the tooling out there. So that should make switching much easier. And since it's OCI compliant, it's basically OCI VMs, which is a trend we talked about last week when we talked about, I forget what it was it micro VMs? I think we talked about last week, which supported OCI as well. So this is something like that, but for Mac specifically.
Yeah, the bad news is going to be you won't be able to read the terminal because they're going to migrate it to that new liquid display UX thing that they did. So
I could see that rubbing people the wrong way. I didn't read it too closely. What is it like the opacity with it that's gonna drive some people nuts?
I mean, like, I don't know, like my, my take on the whole thing is, the whole world is focused on AI, and Apple spent 2 years making like a see-through like UX that makes it impossible to read light text on this liquid background. That's kind of how it came across to me, and like looking at all their presentations and everything, and I was like, what the hell did they just do? So I don't know. I guess we'll see. Like, maybe this is one of those cases where, like, they're visionaries and they're ahead of the curve a little bit. But I looked at it and just kind of went, I can't ever see myself getting comfortable with this. It's way too hard to read.
I know, because you hate. I like opacity. I like those things. I have that on mine. And you always can you reduce the or yeah reduce the opacity on your screen so I can actually read what's there. So yeah.
I hate seeing, like, especially when there's like busy stuff behind it. It there's something in my brain that makes it really difficult for me to read that. And this is like what you have. What you have is like nothing compared to what the demos were. They were like crazy, like colorful swirls with an almost clear, transparent window with like light text that like on top of it. So it's like it bought like there's some good like examples of it, like where you can see those icons are all like transparent and or translucent or whatever. I just don't get like how they think, like read look at that one with the African American woman in it in the middle. Like how the hell can you see what those icons say and everything? I don't know. It's
That,
just
oops, that was the video.
yeah, I don't know. It just does not, it just rubs me the wrong way. Like that's the new default. It looks like something's broken. Like, but they spent 2 years doing this on purpose.
What's weird to me is it doesn't seem radical to me. And aesthetically, yeah, here or there, but from my accessibility standpoint, it seems like a nightmare.
Yeah, it seems awful.
And objectively, I could see that people might not like that. Hey, Jonathan?
Yeah, I just agree completely with Matt. I work for an accessibility company, but more than that, for a couple of years in the last decade, I was functionally blind. I really needed high contrast screens and as much screen real estate as I could get. And this is a nightmare for being able to read it if your sight is not good.
Yeah, and honestly, to me, this like watching like I watched the announcements and everything, admittedly at like high speed and some recaps and everything, but it seems like they came out and they were like, all right, guys, we spent all this time. Look what we did. Aha! Like, this was awesome. And everyone, I think, kind of was like, why the hell did you do that? Like, and
Oh
that's
no, they were
all you
like, yeah,
did.
cool. But tell me about the AI. When is Siri getting updated?
Yeah, exactly. Like, talk about absolutely missing the bus. They had like, they had an AI, like an early AI that everyone in the entire ecosystem is using. Whatever, 7 years ago, 8 years, I don't know how long ago Siri came with, and they've just done nothing to make it better and let everyone pass them by. It's just I don't know. This is kind of my like Steve Cook would have Steve Cook Steve Jobs Steve Jobs would have fired like everyone over this like series of missteps that they've taken. So I don't know. I was definitely underwhelmed with everything that came out. So anyway, that's just my take.
But the fact that it was so little on the AI side was really disappointing.
I mean, honestly, like to I not even AI. It just feels like so little on all fronts. Like, what did they really announce? Okay, like the containerization thing, yeah, I got it. It was like this is pretty cool, like, whatever, but like what have they been spending all their time and billions of dollars on? I mean, give me Apple's budget for a year and like a team the size of them, and I swear I could definitely come up with better than let's make all our interface see-through. I would be like, I would be definitely making
I
impact
got
on the
it. It hit
world.
me last night.
Yeah, it just seems crazy to me that that's what an organization with as much influence and engineering talent as Apple has, this is the main thing that they produced in the year and a half or whatever they've been working on it. So I don't know. I
I was
was.
excited about another announcement, but then I read that Google has had this for like 5 years, so I was a little bit less ex well less impressed. The I oh yes, iOS 6 adding call screening. So telemarketers will be basically intercepted by an AI receptionist that they have to state their intent, and you get to choose if you want to accept it after that point or not.
Yeah. That would be good for me because like my backup for that has been I send all unknown numbers to voicemail, and then someone has to leave me a voicemail, and then I have to call them back if it's someone that I want to talk to. So this would be
Then it
good.
never works when you are, and then when that you call that one customer support thing and we'll call you right back, and then you always miss those calls.
Yeah. Because they call back from a different number than the number you called.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. Yeah. All right. Next one. Maybe a quick bait, but I think there's some interesting truths to it or parallels. Let's see here. So I can't show you the article here, but let me paraphrase as best as I can. The idea is that Amazon is cutting the size of their pizza box teams in half, but not reducing the deliverable expectations and work expectations, and instead saying that because of AI, they should be able to accomplish, such amount of work more efficiently. And the parallel there is what happened in Amazon warehouses, where they started replacing more and more team members with automated bots of the kind. And obviously, there it makes sense, right? You would expect the same or not, if not higher, output. So taking kind of that rubric or that paradigm and applying it to software engineering now. I wouldn't like to be in that pressure cooker environment with those expectations, but Amazon is, known for, raising the bar. They have a whole thing called the bar raiser. So interesting
Yeah,
to see.
I think what's interesting is the same types of reactions happened when they introduced the technology into their warehousing, where people there basically said like, these are unrealistic expectations, even with automation, and like there was all sorts of outcry about the number of people that they laid off and yada yada. But at the end of the day, they actually proved out that it did work, like over time. There was a rough period, but then they were right. So I'm assuming that they feel like they're going to have the same kind of success over some short term rough period, and then have it in the long term. So it'll be interesting to see how it all pans out. And I'm sure they're not using just off the shelf models that aren't custom trained on anything, or all that kind of stuff. They're
I
doing a
see it
lot.
twofold, right? Like, what is the birth or the genesis of AWS Cloud? It was the infrastructure that they used for themselves. And then they commoditized it and leased it. So they have the bedrock and all their AI stuff. So I think it makes a lot of sense that if they were doing this, that they would say, hey, you need to be using what we have and we need to make our tools better because this is where things are going. And it's a forcing function to improve those things.
Yeah, I'm also just purely saying that, like, the organizations of the sizes of most of the people on the call, and ourselves included, we can't afford to build and train our own coding models to be hyper specific to the problem domains that we're working on. So we work with these generic models that do a pretty good job. When
I
you have
see
an
now.
engineering organization the size of Amazon, they can build their own custom models. They can dedicate a team to doing that so that the output is even multiples better than what we're seeing right now, for their specific problem domains. So I think that they have a really good shot of achieving what they're trying to achieve, with some short-term, rough patches. But in the long term, I think that it will work out for them.
Yeah, that's a really good nuance I didn't catch. So thanks for pointing that out. Hey, Jonathan.
I'm going to argue the contrary there. If you remember, there was a period where companies with a lot of resources would go and build their own hardware accelerators, and for AI, for vector processing, for whatever, database processing, and those were almost uniformly failures. NVIDIA and the whole graphics revolution is a standout differentiator and win in that field, but there were so many companies trying to do hardware accelerators that just absolutely failed for decades, 2 decades. And general purpose, the fast progress of the general purpose processors and systems was just overwhelming, because they had such a large economic base. I think one of the things that we are seeing in the large language models is that the concentration of investment in these generalist models has made generalist models so good so fast. So I think I would bet the other way. I mean, I totally agree that an Apple or an Amazon has the resources to build those things. Kind of wonder if it's not a tar pit idea, though, that kind of building our own custom is a sort of thing that can work. It can work in very narrow domains. I'm not sure that they can really beat the quality that we see out of OpenAI or Anthropic, in the kind of in general purpose tasks or unconstrained tasks.
Yeah, and I agree with you there, but I don't think that that's what they would set out to do. I think what they would set out to do is like Amazon has millions upon millions of lines of Java code that has been written the Amazon way that none of those models have seen because it's closed source, right? So they're going to train their own models on the Amazon code base to continue to evolve the Amazon code base. To so that they can replace developers who are doing, menial tasks. Then maybe they'll keep, still keep their highest level critical thinkers who are coming up with the big ideas and how things should work, but they're going to then instruct some LLM, go code this according to these standards, and then those things are going to happen, right? I think you're right. I'm not saying that Amazon is going to beat OpenAI or Claude or, any other Anthropic, model for general purpose AI. And I don't think they'll try to do that. I think they'll try to either take all those other models and learn what they can learn from them and build their own or build on top of one of them as a base to custom train everything on the Amazon way of coding, of assembling things, of logging, of everything that they do internally. And you get hyper specific customized code agents that work within the walls of Amazon, not worrying about general purpose. I think that's
And in
kind
the
of what I was arguing.
multi-agentic sense, that's all they need because they can still leverage all the other things. And then for the fine-tuning or for specific kinds of queries, they use the
Well, that's the point. Is it really? I think it will do exactly as you said. It will produce the best Amazon-like code. The question is that overfitting? Is Amazon Java code, say, the world's best model? You have to assume that
for
Amazon,
Amazon, it is. That's the
for are
thing.
we?
Maybe, but you have to assume that it is the world-beating model compared to all other developers and all other sources of Java intelligence and evolution to. I guess the word I would use is overfit. And that's a real danger in model training, is that you overfit to one data source, and the whole LLM revolution has been the bringing kind of all of the things in the world to bear, as opposed to bringing very, very specific models. I think it's a good, I mean, it's a great
Yeah,
question. I
different.
think I would be very concerned if I were them about spending those millions of dollars and then finding that they've overfit.
Yeah, I think though the just the argument to wrap it up though is I agree with you, but all of the other people who have built these models have been building them for generalized public consumption so that anyone can pick up this model and code and do all of these things. So they need to be a lot less opinionated and also be able to handle, a varying amount of situations. I mean, if Amazon is saying we spend $4 billion a year on junior engineers every year, we can build this custom model for $200 million, and for the next 10 years, we don't need those junior engineers anymore. That's a giant ROI for them. Even if it is, can only do exactly what those junior engineers used to do. I mean, it's huge, right? And they still can keep their top level, or they can hire even more top level strategic thinkers that come up with the big ideas that aren't just the executors. And I think that's like that actually has a lot of potential for an organization that has the resources and both, human capital and engineering thought leadership and dollar resources that Amazon does. I think they could do a ton with that if they if they focus on that. So I don't know. I would bet on it. Like maybe I will. I'll go buy some more Amazon stock and see what happens.
Good way to bet.
They've done pretty well for me over the last 15 years or so. So
Yeah. If there's somebody going to figure it out, I think it's going to be their systematic approach. So,
yeah, or Google, one of the two of them. Like the from
yeah,
an engineering perspective, they
they will.
those two organizations figure a lot of crap out. I'll just say that.
Yeah. So another announcement was AWS has made the OIDC Federation for IAM safer by design or by default now, requiring always that the subject claim, the issuer, and what was the other one? The other field, I forget. Anyways, that those three fields are always set. Previously, it would accept a I don't know what is the technical word. It would ex if you didn't specify that, it would basically be wildcarded, and it could have it had dire consequences if that trust relationship was misconfigured, because it would have trusted literally any. For example, if you misconfigured it on GitHub, you could have literally given any GitHub repository access to your AWS organization if you didn't specify the correct subject claim and issuer. The next announcement is.
How is that different from the current OIDC? Do we know?
Oh, it's the same. It's just that it wasn't required to specify those things before. Now it is required. Yeah.
Gotcha.
I think the reason that this is happening is they're taking a step, and I think they even allude to it in that article. I think that was the same one that I read, but I think they're going to have like a canonical like right now every AWS account has to install like the GitHub like OIDC IDP. Like you have to create one in your account and then federate with that, and it has its own unique ARN and all of that kind of thing. I think they're going to start having public OIDC ones for well-known OIDC integration points, where you can essentially have, they'll just have like a canonical one for GitHub that you can give that access to your account, and then you'll use those claims and everything to prove that that is allowed, that certain repositories are allowed, access into your account. And I think what's happening now is that Amazon and GitHub have probably integrated like millions of times between each other, and now they have like all these, all these endpoints that are talking to individual endpoints and accounts, where they can now centralize that to like one single endpoint and get a lot of performance out of like caching and single point to secure and like doing a lot of things there. So, and now you'll just be able to kind of do that. So
Gotcha. Okay.
I think that's kind of the gist of what I read is going, and this is like the step to, yeah, I think it's even right there. See how it says shared versus public or something, or versus private, or however it is.
Right. And this is one of the things is with, especially with Cloud Posse Module, since it's all triggered by GitHub Actions, that's been a big kind of proponent for using OIDC. We use the official GitHub action, authenticate with AWS, and we just have temporary short-lived tokens. Easy peasy, no need to worry about long-lived credentials. We did learn fairly recently about environment, like using environment deployment protection rules. So it's one thing to limit the wildcard to specific branches, but you can go a step further and you can even limit it to only be adoptable by certain environments.
Yeah,
That's a little.
and you can also add workflow to that as well, so that you can make it so that only certain workflows can actually assume those roles as well. So
And
or
workflows of a certain version or like
yeah,
SHA,
you can
right?
pin them to a specific version, yeah.
And we're going down this rabbit hole, and it turns out it's a tad bit trickier because you do need certainly different IAM rules. If you want to have for planning, you want to just have read-only permissions, and that's one IAM rule. For applying, you need the full Monty. You need everything in that IAM rule. Gets a bit tricky to manage.
Maybe. We'll
And then
see.
our SecOps team kind of worries whenever we mess around with OIDC. They know that they have the best interest in heart, but they always worry about, what if he just opens it up to someone else from outside?
Yeah. I love that argument. What if that happens, and what if this, and what if that? But no one ever worries about, well, what happens when the user forgets their password or accidentally gives it to someone else, or the
Or even
store.
basics, like if someone leaves the company, now you have to
Yeah.
manually rotate every single
Everything.
password.
Yeah, it makes no sense. But
It's ridiculous.
the one thing I was gonna say is, I think, was it last week we talked about the, maybe, I don't remember if we talked about it, but the offline IAM like policy modeler. Did you see that? Like, I thought,
No, I don't think I saw
oh,
that.
maybe I thought I sent it. And but there's some tool that came that someone came up with, that essentially will allow you to do, I don't know, I'll have to find it, but it was a new tool. So, but the idea is that it made it much, much, much simpler to do least privilege policy generation. So I was my the reason I went down that path was, I was going to start to say, is if they make that easier, we should be able to have specific roles that you can assume that have only the privileges they need to deploy certain things, right? So that you can't accidentally say, like, so if you say, I'm rolling out this S3 bucket, you can't then like destroy your VPC using those same credentials or whatever, because right now most people are just giving that apply role like full admin permissions because there's no simpler way. But if we could actually look at resources that are being modified and get like good quality policies around them, then you could really go crazy and make it secure.
Provided you pro practice proper componentization and you're
Yeah,
not
of course.
terrible.
Yes.
Like
But
a
that
sweetheart.
was kind of my point, is that if you could do that so that like a component then could have like an IAM policy attached to it, so that you're saying when you're deploying this component, you need these permissions, then you could have a role that only has those permissions, or you I forget what the term is of that, where you assume a role, but you narrow your permissions in your in the role assumption. So you can have like you can actually have a role assumption of a role that has higher permissions but only ask for fewer permissions than that. And I forget what AWS calls it, but that would also be interesting if we could somehow figure that out.
It's a bit unfortunate, but there is a pretty old team in our organization, and they love Atlantis. That's their thing, that's their jam for many years, and they want to keep using it. And we kind of have come through with GitHub Actions, Cloud Policy Modules. Everything's just handled for you. You don't need to maintain infra. And the biggest proponent is OIDC. This team took it upon themselves to make a GitHub Action workflow to grab AWS credentials the usual way, store them in Vault. And then Atlantis retrieves it via webhook in order to run it. Just the lens to go to support existing things.
I wonder what would do all of that though. Like, wouldn't
Oh,
like
and
the
also the GitHub Action is smart enough to check the age of the secret in the vault. If it's more than an hour, it updates it with a new
Why not use
session.
the Vault CLI in this situation?
That's what I was going to ask. Vault can
You
do that
absolutely
directly.
can. You
Yeah.
absolutely can. You absolutely can. And these guys are just. They're set in their ways.
All right.
It's
Yeah.
sad, but hey ho, we'll get there. Baby steps.
All right. I'm sorry for you there. Last two announcements. One was nothing that interests me too much, more out of just this word, like fascination. Broadcom bought VMware, drove up with something like 7x or 10x the prices of a lot of those renewals. A lot of unhappy enterprises. I didn't know that this existed. So now you can actually use VMware Cloud inside of AWS. Obviously, for those big enterprises. And then the last announcement was Amazon open sourcing PG Active, which is how they've accomplished Active-Active for Postgres. Well, I guess that's them being a good steward of open source. They obviously are using Postgres internally.
Yeah, I bookmarked this to take a look at it. I was curious if it's eventually consistent, or if they use log shipping, or how they actually do it, like underneath the hood.
What's the license on this? Batch two. Interesting date, 2 years ago. So makes me scratch my head. Like, this was just announced, I think. But it's kind of weird that the license is Apache 2 from 2 years ago.
Well, it might have been that this was all part of some other repo, and they moved here, and then finally decided to open source it.
Interesting. All right, that's all I got. Rishabh, I know I put you on the spot in Slack this past week. You were doing something interesting with using, was it OpenAI to provide human-friendly output of failures, so to help developers accelerate their triaging. Is there anything you can show on that, or you want to share a little bit more what you're experimenting with? Oh, you're muted, by the way.
Oh, what a rookie. I sure can. Yeah, I won't take up too much time, but yeah, you explained it perfectly. It's just, I think about a month or so ago, GitHub came up with GitHub models, and that is, at least for the time being, something that's free, that's rate limited, but you can access it freely. And all I wanted to kind of marry was a lot of our workflows are maintained by DevOps guys, but developers who actually use it on a day-to-day basis, they're not always kind of fully familiar with it. If, for example, a workflow fails because Docker Hub is rate limited, they don't always know what to do next, and it's usually a, hey, call SRE or someone to help us. So that's what I wanted to try and do is, what if we just had quote-unquote ChatGPT built into the workflow and it runs the query for you and spits out some results? And that was a goal, and we spent a bit of a weekend or so on it, and it went fairly well-ish. It's just this little open source repository right here. Let me know if you can see my screen all right. Magic, nice one. And it really just boils down to, if you have a GitHub workflow like this, you can choose your model. GPT 4.1 mini is probably one of the cheaper ones at the moment. You can pass in your system prompt, and then you can pass in your user prompt. For this one, super easy, just to demo things that you can ask a question and it spits it back at you. But you can get a little bit more involved with it. So to give an example of how we are using it internally, we have this experiment we're doing right now with trying to deploy out jobs with Nomad. And it's a little bit tricky at times to understand why a deployment failed. If we take a quick little peek at some of this, and this is all public or data, so this isn't anything crazy, but this is somewhere where we tried to deploy to two environments. One of them failed, which not great, but if we have a quick peek at the bottom of the workflow or the bottom of the comment, we have this little collapsible dropdown. And opening this up, everything here is just all GPT 4.1 generated. And for
This
what it's
is
worth, this is a
hilarious.
manufactured fault. We actually broke its access just for this environment, just to see what it would do. And it tries its darndest to set us on the right path. Everything from checking the tokens, checking permissions, like these are genuinely useful steps for anyone, even guys who are experienced with this.
Did you pass it a context of the changes in the PR as well, so it also saw what you were trying to do?
And that's exactly what we're trying to get to. So right now this API is open-ended, which is great, but I don't know how what the limit of the context is, if there is one. And if you do want to pass it in, it's a very kind of a strenuous process of what needing to package up each file into a JSON-friendly format and then sending it in. So that's what we're trying to do with this open source project is right now it's just very basic, very bare bones. You can pass in a line or two and it
Can
spits
you show
something
the
out.
workflow? Because that's what kind of made it click for me, and how you were able to achieve this.
Oh yeah.
If always or whatever you did at the very
Oh
end.
yeah, of course. So it'll be a little bit something like, oh, this is going to be not very pretty, but hey, it's all for the sake of this. So we take a peek at this Nomad workflow, skip past a little bit of this, check out repo, get current PR, fetch dependencies, and here's where we have the step where we try and deploy the Nomad pack. Says something simple, basic Nomad pack, run, and that's it. If it failed, so it's only ever triggering this step. If there is a failure, it pulls together a bit of a JSON payload. It passes in all kinds of things like the system prompt, as well as the output error log that we get from the previous step, passes that all into the JQ payload, and then it appends the output into the same PR comment that it would have made anyway, but it passes it in as an extra little tidbit. So the idea being, if it is unhelpful succession, it's not going to get in your way. It's not going to clutter your PR view. It's just there as a little bit of a jumping off point for folks who might not know what the next steps are.
Yeah,
Yeah.
that's really cool. I think that this probably in an ideal world would be better implemented as a GitHub app
You're
that
absolutely
basically
spot on.
that basically could get the that would get the like a webhook of the result of the job, and then it could then like get source files and analyze them like in their context without having to pass anything. It basically could just read right from there and run the model over that and decide what files to pass to the context of the model from that perspective. So, but it's
Not only are you right, that was literally one of our inspiration is I can't see if I can find one right now, but if you have GitHub Copilot, which I'm sure you probably have to somewhere, if you look at past workflows, especially ones that failed, there's usually a something in the bottom right where it's like, hey, do you want help troubleshooting this workflow with Copilot? And every time we've tried that internally, it's never been hugely helpful. It has all the context, it has all the logs, but it gives you super, super generic troubleshooting suggestions rather than here's the step that failed, here's the command, here's the output. And that's, yeah, I don't know why that is.
That just seems to be the reoccurring theme with a lot of the Copilot feedback that I really want Microsoft to succeed with these things, and they're the perfect platform for it, and they provide a lot for us all. Yeah, the Copilot is needing help.
It's so close yet so far. And that's one of the things, like in an ideal world, I would totally imagine this project isn't really necessary. You have your AI troubleshooting steps there
Fair enough.
automatically for you right there. But
I'm
hey,
curious.
business for little baby steps.
So, since we're on a Copilot topic, and I know they had announced this, that I think it could write PR summaries. And a couple, I think Dan, you saw it on your screen. I know Ben on his screen could get it. I can't figure out what to enable, and I even pay for a seat of Copilot. And when I go to a PR, I don't have the option for it to generate the summary.
No.
Anybody know more about that?
Did you check your account settings,
Yeah,
developer?
well, as best I could, yeah. Do you
Along
remember
with you,
enable
I have
something
Copilot as
specifically
well,
for
and
that? Oh,
I
sorry,
don't
what
think
was
I've
it?
seen that feature either, to be honest. I've heard of it, but I don't think I've seen it ruled out yet.
Yeah, let's see here. So if I go to GitHub or github.com, Paucity Atmos.
It's disabled because it says CEO in your bio.
Too dangerous. So, like, if I click on this and edit it, for the team members that have it, they have some Copilot icon here somewhere, and it'll up generate the PR description. And I don't understand why I don't get it.
I think I found it. If you go to Copilot and right there, or go to your personal profile, like settings.
Yeah.
In
I
that
think,
menu,
yeah, and then your co-pilot or
that might go to the same place. Yeah, that's the same place. So right there, editor features disabled.
yeah, where?
Huh.
How do I enable that? And when I click learn more, I believe this link didn't tell me how to enable.
Did
Is
you
this?
sign up for like Copilot? There was some way I signed up for it because of open source contributions. They gave it to
Oh,
me
that's
for free.
probably what why you got it. Yeah, I forget if I did or not sign up for that. If we find that. Free for maintainers, this here. Yeah, I'll look at that afterwards. Just. Anybody happen to know right away? All right. Well, very cool, Rishabh. Thanks for sharing that. I think it's a cool application of
Thank
that.
you.
For what it's worth, if you go back to that thing on the top, it says like, I don't know if it says the same thing as what you is what it says for mine. If you go back to your Copilot, it says Copilot Pro is active for your account on the top. So you have Copilot Business. So I don't know if those are different, but and that's like on mine too. I have like all those ones that say disabled on yours say enabled on mine. So, but I did the same thing. I applied through the like open source contributor thing, and GitHub gave me like a Copilot Pro like license or whatever.
Well, I should go try that for another reason. Really weird though. We pay for an active seat and I still can't get it. And I thought it was a policy setting somewhere, and I looked at the organization and I looked at our enterprise, and I can't find it in any of those. All right. Let's see here. So yeah, Q&A, man. Anybody got a good question for us? We got 7 minutes or so.
More so curiosity than anything else. Has anyone looked into the recent GitHub models thing that they've been pushing? So it's a new tab along the top of your repository, just like
I
Actions or
saw that.
whatever. And apparently, this lets you trial out prompts, compare it between different prompts or different models for the same prompt, and you have to enable it like on a repo by repo basis. That's it. Yeah, that's exactly the one. Yeah. Oh no. You've blocked
Okay,
it.
maybe this is the same thing that's preventing the other thing from me working, so.